Hello and welcome to So Farscape,
a fun-filled Farscape fancast by a fervent fan
and a fresh-faced first-timer.
I'm Kaki.
I'm Kay.
And this is the story so Farscape. We're getting good at this.
Yeah, we've got some practice at this. I mean, this is episode 7, that 107 that we're at.
Yes, and this is the story so far case, so Farscape, where the American science jock John Crichton has been shot through a wormhole into some distant part of the universe and is on a ship.
With some...
A living ship. Come on.
Oh, living ship.
Yeah,
sorry, yes.
There you go.
Yeah, with some other escapees from the society known as the Peacekeepers.
Right. We've got Zan, the supposedly pacifist priest. She's blue and she's beautiful.
And we've got Tentacles, or Dargo, as he's colloquially
as
known.
He's boringly known. No, Tentacles is
although
way
better. Although we learn that he's called Khal Dargo in this episode. But
Khal Dargo, yeah. So Dargo, apparently he's from a culture that puts their surname first.
Yeah. And, and of course, Earbrows.
Yes, that's right. Dominar Rigel the 16th, and he's a Muppet.
The disposed tyrant of a...
I like that you invented a new word there. It's like half despised and half deposed.
Well, yes, disposed. Well,
the disposed tyrant. No, that's correct.
Of 6 billion subjects, I believe he's...
600 billion!
600 billion! 600 billion!
600 billion!
And, I mean, I was going to say, lastly, Erin, but while she's the peacekeeper, who has been banished from her own people.
Yes,
she's
on the run. Yeah, given the choice, she would have not chosen this life either.
Yeah, so, it's such a weird position for her to be in.
Although they seem to be getting along quite well. I mean, there's a little bit of friction here and there, but in general, the crew seems to be melding into a... I won't say a well-oiled machine, but at least they seem to tolerate each other's foibles.
All the sort of grit has been sanded down to a sort of bearable size. Oh, what's that word? Society means like shaving the corners off of everybody's freedom so that they all fit next to each other
And I guess they've they figured out how each other's personalities works, and when they say something or the other, then it's not necessarily meant as an affront or anything. They're just like figuring out how everybody interacts with each other,
because there is a lot of opportunity for affront. I mean, everyone there, except for John, hates the peacekeepers, and she, Erin is a peacekeeper, and it's this powder keg, and yet it doesn't always ignite the way that you think, because they've all sort of...
And we're actually starting to learn a little bit more about the peacekeepers. I mean, last episode was more like, apparently the peacekeepers like have some rather disreputable techniques for getting the oil that they fuel their weapons with.
Yes. Last week was, what was it? Thank God it's Friday again.
Yeah, and again and again and again.
And again and again. And we find out that there's a planet that has been seeded with a crop that is hugely destructive and sort of psychologically...
addictive,
yeah.
Well, it's not addictive. It's never mentioned that it's addictive, but it seems to like make people very compliant. And
docile, it's a depressant, and the way that peacekeepers manufacture their weapons fuel is to enslave populations and contaminate planets with this crop from which they're like... We were led to believe in the first episode that they were leaving peacekeeper territory by heading into the uncharted territories.
And yet they keep coming across more and more peacekeeper artifacts, relics, whatever you want to call it, like the peacekeeper presence, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because last episode was about the crop for the fuel. This episode, it deals with where they find a ship.
Yes. This episode, PK Tech Girl, episode 107, I've been really, really, really excited to share with you, as I have with every episode so far, because they're all brilliant. But this is widely regarded by the crew and by fans alike as the moment where Farscape really sort of found its voice.
Okay.
And from a production standpoint, it's also kind of remarkable, because this is the first one that was filmed on its own.
Oh, right. Because it wasn't done in the twofer system that they were
exactly.
using before.
And so everyone was focusing on just one story, and it's much better.
It didn't jump out at me it being particularly different, but it might have been just a different style to it. It seemed to be a little bit more coherent in its consistent.
Yeah,
is the word.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Although I was thinking, like, we never do find out what PK stands for, do we? Oh, peacekeeper, of course. Duh.
Well,
thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. No. No. Some of us do find out eventually.
It was never mentioned specifically, but then again, that might have been.
But there again, like, these episode titles were never meant to be public.
Ah, okay, they were just working titles.
Yeah, they were just sort of internal, it's the Back to the Future one.
You have a good point. It's like there's no, in the credits or anything, there's no mention of an episode title like you see in Star Trek.
they weren't written with titles in mind. It was just an easy way to sort of keep them apart. Oh, we're which one are we doing now? Oh, we're doing the Peacekeeper Tech Girl.
Yeah.
Prepare to stop her.
So we have an opening shot of Rigel's eyes, and it's like we've got those little beady nostrils and his big pupils. And then I noticed immediately that, like, the hologram of Pilot seems to be much higher in quality than anything we've seen before. It's like...
Right?
It really jumped out at me.
Yeah, because previously he was rendered with all of these, like, scan lines, like it was a VHS hologram.
Also a bit bluer. He's more greenish now.
Right. He's actually got color.
Maybe they had some software upgrade on Moya and... Now Pilot is in higher resolution.
Yeah.
They have found a derelict ship.
I love that it starts with a close-up of Rigel's eye and with the ship and the... Like, it's in a planetary ring system. And do you notice how it's among the rings?
Yes.
It's
kind of sticking out.
Between them.
Oh, it's sticking in one of those empty gaps? Yeah, so it is.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, we say sticking in one of those empty gaps. Why was the gap exactly fit the ship?
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense that the ship would sweep up the gap if everything rotates and the ship doesn't rotate at the same time. That's not how orbital mechanics work.
Well, okay. No. Okay, well, I'm sure we'll get into how orbital mechanics work. Because I was totally captivated by, like, the choices in colors throughout Farscape so far. Like, you look at that image of the derelict ship in the planetary rings with the sun coming up, and there's all of these ochres, and wow.
A lot of space colors are always very orangey, I've noticed.
Well, I mean, certainly in Farscape, where, I mean, that's the color of the Command and of
right.
Moya.
Moya's so. Inside seems to be very ochreish. And,
there's a lot of desert colors, I've noticed.
Yeah, definitely lit. I mean, it's all a little bit dark with lots of, like, lighting where you're really wondering where is it coming from. But it's like, I mean, the lighting crew must have had a damn job to get that all set up.
Oh, wow, yeah. I mean, you've got a lot of lights on the bridge, and a lot of them are these.
And the Command, wasn't it? What they called it?
You are right. You are right. Yeah. It's called the Command. I remember seeing some of the early production art where the idea was that the lights themselves would be sort of mobile, that they're these sort of light emitting spiders that crawl over the inside of the ship, and so the lights would always be in different spots.
Oh, that must have made it a real nightmare for the crew to deal with that.
So interesting.
But yeah, it turns out that the ship that they immediately recognize for some reason or the other is the Zelbinon, which has been lost for 100 years.
The Zelbinion.
Zelbinion. Sorry, that's right.
That's what Rigel identifies it as.
Yes.
Like, he's the one who recognizes it on sight, despite the fact the identity of the ship is a bit of a mystery to most on the. On the Command. Like, we have another one of those moments where they're all trying to work out a consensus.
Reverse course.
We leave here now.
John wants to get out of there.
Yeah, no kidding. Like, shouldn't we be doing warp 1,000 by now?
Once he realized it's Peacekeeper.
GTFO.
Yeah, exactly. Zan is in the same boat. But I think it's Dargo who wants to look
for... Yes, he wants to go looking for weapons and supplies and just loot the ship.
And the more modest approach of trying to find, like, maps.
And I say that there's information on her data spools that could lead us home.
Something that Crichton still hasn't really invested a lot of time in.
Yeah, I was surprised. That actually comes up a little bit later when they're when they're inside the ship. And, like, Crichton completely ignores it. There's, like, nothing about it. Like, I'd have thought that he would be more enthusiastic about that as well. Yes.
Like, he is so far beyond the idea of ever getting back. Like, he just doesn't care about the maps. And everybody else cares much more about getting him home than he does.
Go away. Go home. Home. Go home. Shoot.
And they don't care a lot.
No, that's very true. It's still mentioned every time in the opening crawl, so...
Erin is, like, you see on her face, she is in a different... She responds to this very differently than everybody else, because this is, like, her culture. This is her people. She needs to know who this is.
And I need to know who she is.
And Rigel, of all people, has the answer.
It's the Zelbinion.
Which then she recognizes and goes, like, oh, the ship was lost 100 cycles ago.
Like, it's a ship with some renown. Like, even the Luxans
know about it. Yes.
And it was considered undefeatable.
Although it's never mentioned what it does or what it was supposed to do or where it was used, what it was used for, other than as a prisoner, also a prisoner ship used to torture Rigel.
Because that's where he spent, like, the first years of his cycles of his life being
tortured. Not of his life, of his banishment.
Of his imprisonment. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Crichton is the one who he tries once again to be a little bit of the voice of reason. Like, this thing got shot to shit. Imagine what the winner of this fight looks like.
Think how big the winner of this battle must be.
And let's not find out.
Yeah, we never find out what's actually went on with the ship and how it happens. So they decide to get on board the ship. And I love this shot where you have, like, Tentacles walking down the corridor with his keyblade.
I'm gonna have to stop you there. So his quarter blade, the bad sword that he sharpens with crusty dishcloth, you were calling that the keyblade, which is a reference to Kingdom Hearts.
Kingdom Hearts, yes.
Yeah. Kay, you were so good at this. They should have hired you to write Crichton's lines.
Followed by Erin also carrying her big gun. Like, actually a bigger gun, I think. She's moved on from the star
They're
modification.
They're getting bigger every time,
and
right?
It's like it's turning more into aliens right now with, like, the big side carry.
Yeah, you're right. She's like Vasquez. Yep. Except she sort of looks like Come On Eileen with her... You know what I mean? With her suspenders.
And last in line is Crichton carrying a torch. So I thought that was kind of like a...
Yeah, it's his own little lightsaber.
A little flashlight, and it's...
As they're walking down the hallway of Moya and then just straight up into the Zelbinium, because apparently, like, Moya is docking directly this time.
Yeah.
Did you notice how, like, there's no airlock, there's no docking collar or whatever.
It's completely... hand waved, how it happens, how it's done.
You can sort of see it. Like, they walk down a hallway, and then the next hallway is the exterior hatch, and they just walk in there. Like,
I mean, maybe Moya just opened a sphincter on the outside, and
that's what I was thinking. Like, she's got just one of her side puckers just
opens up and
against it's like, the. she's giving the Zelbinian like a docking kiss.
Yes, and they
docking snog. No, we can do this.
A docking snog. But yeah, it changes immediately because, like, you don't have the organic ribs or whatever you want to call them that Moya has all over the
rectangular.
And suddenly, the lighting turns blue and it's like it's all straight corridors and it's like you're on
dark,
it's on the Nostromo. There's gratings, there's leaking, there's pipes all over the place.
You know, it's so cool that you said the Nostromo, which is the mining vessel from the first Alien film, because from a very early point, a lot of the sort of vision for Farscape among the producers was like halfway between Star Wars and Alien, right? And we've seen mostly Star Wars. We've seen mostly the cantina, and we've seen the sort of fanciful organic architecture. And they sort of wanted to get to something that was fantastic and adventurous, but also like a lot more earthy and a little bit more menacing.
I mean, both Star Wars and Alien have this lived-in look.
Yes,
which
exactly.
is like so completely diametrally opposed to Star Trek, which is like all pristine and...
Yes, it's all polished
clean.
And...
Yeah, I watched all kinds of Star Trek.
Everything in Star Wars and in Alien looks used. It looks old, it looks repaired.
It looks like someone like thought about maintaining it and then had something better to do.
Yes.
Come on, baby! Why don't you just get it fixed?
And then fix it! That's why it works when I whack it a few times!
And it's something that Erin is very nostalgic about as they're walking through these dark hallways, these dark dripping hallways that sort of look like, okay, when you were in school, like secondary school, like high school, you ever been to your school when it was dark?
Yes.
With the lights out, I was a theater nerd, and so we'd occasionally walk down, and it was such a weird world. That's what I thought about as she was walking to, because this is a spaceship, and when the spaceship has the lights out, it just feels like the soul's gone, like it's a graveyard.
I see what you mean. I mean, that's very aptly said, because like it doesn't take very long before they find their first corpse.
Whoa!
Which is lying on top of a grate and it's kind of like leaking stuff.
There's a good little fright moment for Crichton when he turns up his flashlight and he sees this this desiccated, like mummified corpse. And okay, so there is water dripping everywhere.
Yes.
There's water dripping past this corpse. Erin says, "Oh,
deep space desiccation."
No, it's not been in vacuum or anything. At least I don't suspect it has been. I mean, there's no...
So there has been some reference to, like, a lot of the ship is exposed to vacuum. A pilot recommends that you stay starboard and high.
Oh, yes. So they did, yeah. So there might have been, like, areas which have been not... On the other hand, starboard and high is the part that is sticking out of the rings and not the part that is getting battered by the rings of this planet there around.
I wonder, like, what is high relative to... To the axis of the ship or to the axis of the planet?
I would think so.
Because you wouldn't be able to navigate.
No, exactly. It makes more sense to do it in reference to the layout of the ship.
Right.
Just like starboard is, like, in reference to the ship.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So high makes, stay on the top side.
Hey, can I just make a little observation about us? this is like, we're really on point in describing this episode. We're not being very silly.
No.
Do you notice that?
It's been fairly serious so far.
It's a really serious episode, yeah. Right? You can even hear that in how we're talking about it. Like, he encounters a corpse, deep space desiccation, and then we're back on the bridge, and Zahn...
Yeah, Zahn's playing Ouija board on the console.
Yes.
The giant Ouija board says optimum plus 3.
And she's noticing some strange behavior about Rigel as well. Like,
I expected you to go looting, Rigel.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't loot. I'm the or I shouldn't stoop. That's what he said.
I shouldn't stoop so low.
Well, you did stoop to the last, like, three...
Which I noticed. So apparently they've been having a little bit of a history of, like, looting ships and, like, finding derelicts and...
Yeah.
Or was it four?
Like, are you finding these left and right? Like, how many derelict ships are there out of space? How easy are there to find?
Yeah, and this is completely glossed over that apparently this is a thing that they've been doing.
We haven't seen that.
This is the first time we've seen them board a different ship, especially in a way like this with a derelict ship.
But he explains that, like, he is... terrified of that ship,
right.
Because that's
where he was tortured after he was disposed. I believe we called him.
We're going to keep that.
I mean,
one.
If you can get indisposed, I mean, I suppose it can be disposed.
Yes, he's the disposed. No, that one doesn't make sense. No.
The disposed ruler.
The crew on board the Zelbinian, they make it on through the through essentially the mausoleum onto the command of the command carrier. And like, I noticed that this is a redress of the set where Krace stomped about in the first episode, because like, he was in command of command carrier as well.
Right.
Like, that was also a ship.
And also, they have this weird, like, organic growths all over the place, which is completely not mentioned at all. There's like these weird, I don't know what it was. It kind of like looked like
it
got overgrown.
You mean. It sort of looks like a thorny limb
of
a tree.
A termite mound or something like that.
I think maybe that's supposed to be just a lump of like some sheet metal that fell down,
yeah.
Or sort of pockmarked or whatever. But yeah, it does sort of feel like jungly as they're walking around here and noticing, like, it has been stripped bare.
Yep, even the star charts are gone.
Oh, okay, well, just a quick announcement for the readers at home. We are joined by a special guest, Kay's cat, who is in the throes of the fourth sensation.
Yes, hunger.
Hunger.
This is where we learn about Creighton's disinterest in star charts all of a sudden, because Aaron mentions
right,
this, and it's
yeah.
Like, he completely glosses over it. It's like not mentioned at all. He's much more interested in the corpse he sees there lying around.
Yeah, and there's quite a lot of them. Now, it does sort of make sense that the crew would have gone down with their ship,
yeah.
And they would have concentrated in the command.
And yet they find a living person.
Oh, the dead are alive. The los muertos vivos están. And one of them, like one of these corpses, sort of jumps out at him because it was being used as a disguise by someone who's still alive. Lots of like gun waving and threatening ensues.
But Crichton pretty much jumps right in front of the person involved. When Aaron points a gun at her.
No! No!
As soon as he realized, oh, it's a girl.
What, you're a girl? I'm going to open the door for you?
Yes.
I must protect her with my masculine jockey body. I must stand in front of all this violence being directed at this poor girl.
And Aaron and this, the PK Tech girl, I suppose, which the episode
yes.
is named after, have a little standoff. And turns out that she's like a techie, immediately getting bullied by Aaron.
We've got the credits, which is always like a good moment to take a little breather and sort of look at the cold open, as it's known. We have the cold open.
It
where
was
we're
a fairly long one, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's quite a few scenes. Like they actually make it onto the command. That's a good observation. I wonder if they're usually longer or shorter. I've never really paid attention.
I think the longest cold open is probably still one of the episodes of Breaking Bad, where they're about like halfway into the episode before they do the.
That could be I think the OA has them beat the fantastic Netflix series where you make it through like 45 minutes of the 50-minute opening episode and then there's the credits, and like when that happened and then there's like 5 minutes of episodes left, like wow. So on the bridge we have Aaron pacing back and forth doing the sort of Arlie Ermy what's it called, the
drill sergeant thing,
yes,
which he actually gets called by Creighton.
Why don't you give it a rest, Miss Drill Sergeant?
And Creighton, God, you've got me saying Creighton now.
Creighton.
In this moment, I was with Aaron. I'm like, she calls him out on it.
This is my world, John. Don't interfere.
He's an alien here, and he should shut the hell up.
And she's totally drilling this poor little tech girl, like, who are you, what is your rank, who are you working for? Turns out she is from the Mad Commander's ship.
Yes,
she's from her ship, they know each other.
And this is a pretty terrifying bit of news, and she's lucky that Dargo is off doing something else, that he doesn't like immediately decide to execute her to cover their tracks, because he's so busy foraging, I'm sorry, foraging. Have you noticed his accent in this?
Opportunistic foragers.
Like, I've noticed it before, how Dargo says that the Uncharted Territories, and now they're foraging.
In the Uncharted Territories.
No, I hadn't noticed that. I did notice, however, that when he's like, he goes off into check the rat chamber or whatever it is, and he almost does this judo roll off screen. And he just like ducks into
the chamber.
And he ducks away.
He does that, yeah. It's almost like he rips off his shirt and does a James T. Kirk
exactly.
judo roll. Very good. Yeah. Crichton sort of stands up for the PK tech girl, for which she eventually thanks him, that he says that he tries to save one life every day, and it's usually his own.
Yeah, I thought that was rather amusing.
Meanwhile, we have a little aside between Rigel and Zan again,
mm-hmm.
where she advises him to confront his demons.
Like, yes,
he's afraid of it. And
I think I was meant to die here the first time. That's why the spirits have brought me back to the Zelbinian.
He's like, he's probably dead on board the ship, and it's like, he goes like, he's not dead to me, and then she could go find him and confront him.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of like, okay, so she's a priest.
Find his corpse. It will set you free.
This is like a 30-second scene, it's not a big deal. And she says, oh, do you know what you should do? You should go on that ship on your own and find a fucking corpse, and then you'll feel better. Hey,
yeah.
If you go and find a corpse, you'll feel better. Oh, that's kind of whack advice.
No, I can see that. I can understand that. Like, she understands that that commander is, like, part of his demons. And, like, the fact that he still has trouble with it, and he doesn't even dare go there, and probably, like, seeing that person dead is probably a good way to put it behind him.
It's, like, everything you're saying makes sense. I mean, yes, that does seem like sound therapeutic advice, but after a more rigorous diagnosis than, oh, I'm scared of something, oh, you should go find a corpse to make yourself feel better. Like, why is that the first thing that she goes for?
It's not just a corpse, it's the corpse of this guy who tortures
him. Any old
him.
Corpse. Yeah. Just go and find a corpse and just piss on it and you'll feel great.
Like, well, pissing doesn't seem to be his thing. It seems to be, spitting seems,
it seems
to be more.
Yes,
he does
exactly.
that. He does that a few times in this episode where he just like hooks up something like brown and goopy and like spits it first in the face of our tech girl.
Jelena. We've learned her name.
Yes.
And he shows himself, just like everybody else that we've met in space so far, to be a huge racist, that he considers it like a great accomplishment for himself that he like shares his living quarters with one of these abominations, yes, meaning the Sabbatians.
I've barely got used to sharing my accommodation with one of these abominations. Dispel the thought of two.
Well, they're having this little argument, and this is where Tentacles shows up again. He runs into screen, then he goes like, well, tell her to cooperate or kill her, and then he judo rolls off screen again. It's like, I just noticed this was like...
because the ship
has been gutted to worthlessness.
Worthlessness. And he's just running left and right and just like ducking into corridors and running onto scene, off scene again.
He is so cool. And I really want him to say like Worcestershire sauce at some point and just see what that sounds like. And we find out some more details of the PK tech girl being left behind because...
Huh? I missed that.
Okay, so she's from Crasis ship.
Yeah.
And she was sort of left there... To do tests on this craft while Krace went on, because Krace is clearly still obsessed.
Yes. She specifically mentioned that, like, you killed his brother, and he goes, like, it was an accident. We bumped into each other. It could have been gone the other way.
But it was an accident.
That was an accident.
It was an accident.
That was an accident.
It was an accident.
I'm telling you, it must have been an accident.
Yeah, like apparently Krace just gave a ship-wide PA and announced to everyone, we're chasing my brother's murderer, and so we're abandoning my mission.
Yes.
And heading into the Uncharted Territories as
it's not Dargo who's saying it, yes.
And what's even worse, like, they find another corpse at this point, but this isn't one of these space-desiccated wet mummies that we've seen so far.
No, it's a burnt corpse, which somehow Jelena immediately recognizes, despite the fact that it's burnt to a crisp, which I thought was an impressive skill.
He's toast!
I sort of imagined that she was there when he was burned.
Oh, that's possible.
Right? She was... because that was the person who was guarding their crew, the rest of whom was also killed, and Erin recognizes the officer as well as someone from her unit. Like, why is he doing this?
This is Grot's work.
Do you notice that? Like, Grot for grunt?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Yeah.
I missed that one as well.
And Angelina reveals that in her absence, her entire unit has been demoted and they can only be reinstated...
once Eren's dead, yes.
That is some hardcore, like...
punishment, yeah.
The Romans didn't even do that. They just do, you know, yeah, decimation.
One in 10 of your own people and...
yeah, and then back to work. Yeah, yeah. No problem.
Now get back to work.
There's a little bit of wandering around, exploring the ship.
Huge, like, that location is fucking fantastic.
Yeah.
I believe that some of the scenes, I don't know if that goes for all of these, but some of these scenes were filmed in an old power plant in Australia.
Yeah.
And the huge cavernous spaces. I think this was the first time, honestly, that I've seen huge cavernous spaces in a spaceship before.
Oh.
I remember being sort of blown away by it. I know that like since then it's become more popular, like the J.J. Abrams Star Trek film, which was also filmed in, I think, a brewery at one point.
Well, I mean, there was like the inside of the Death Star where they were flying around in it. I mean, that was a huge cavernous space inside a spaceship. But
the superstructure, you're right, but like walking around in giant spaces, because when you think of a spacecraft
inside of Bespin, that was not really a spacecraft.
It was intra-atmospheric. You could still breathe, because that's kind of the thing.
Yeah.
You'd expect it to be like firewalled and fire floored, I guess.
Very good point. Yeah.
I absolutely marveled at these huge spaces where they were shining their flashlights and sort of exploring, and he was really confronting just how impressive peacekeeper engineering is.
And after Dargo has done his running off screen again, he now makes his way back.
This is not a judo roll.
Yeah, he manages his way back onto Moira.
Hoo-ha!
Where another ship shows up.
The ship that attacked the Zelbinian after Jelena and her research crew were on board has returned, and it's a species known as the Sheyang. Dargo has identified a lot of their like telltale signs of these Sheyang.
It's the Sheyang. There's evidence of their work all over their ship.
Who are consummate, like...
Right, especially the fire burn, the burning to a crisp of the...
They're opportunistic scavengers.
The Sheyang are nothing more than opportunistic foragers.
Who burn people.
And they start powering up their weapons, and I believe it's Zahn who says, like, we need to show strength or something, or was it Dargo who said that?
Let me think about that. Yeah. Like, I think it's Dargo. Yes. Dargo knows the Sheyang. Like, they flee from strength and they attack on weakness. Because Zahn advises, like, maybe we should tell them we're peaceful and we don't have any weapons.
And then
because,
he says, like, that's not going to work now. Well, they'll attack us if they think we're weak.
And, well, what do they have to do? They don't have any weapons.
Nope.
Moya doesn't have any weapons. The Sheyang have weapons that are far too powerful.
The Zelbinian might have weapons, but, yeah, none of them work. They've all been stripped, apparently, because, like, the ship was already being looted.
But there is one system still working. They noticed some lights on the bridge, and that's the defense screen.
Yes.
Now, unfortunately, it's on what Crichton recognizes as a progressive power draw. Hey, Crichton actually did some science here.
I mean, he even claims about, like, I did my PhD on that. And, like, Jelena asks, what's that? Oh, they just put some letters at the end of your name.
Yes, I mean, he's kind of right.
True, but he doesn't bother explaining that it's, like, a research subject or anything, which would be just as easy. But
well, that's a good point. Like, he could say, oh, it's like ranks for science.
Oh, yeah, that's a very good way to point.
And she'd understand.
No,
it's like, oh, yeah, then because she's, like, a maintenance provost.
Termco support, maintenance provost.
It's like a sanitation engineer, I suppose.
Assistant Deputy Food Science Engineer of Burger Flipping. Speaking of flipping, Rigel, in the meantime, has been exploring the ship, and he has encountered a ghost.
Yes.
He's seen a vision.
He sees the ghost of his tormentor, basically.
Yeah, the feared Captain Durker.
Durker.
Hey, Durker!
Work for Durker.
I think it's like some sort of like communication thing that gets activated and like starts suddenly playing a message of the guy? Or do you think it's entirely...
Really?
Or do you think it's just a flashback?
it sort of looked like we were seeing his memory of Durka.
My first thought that it was like a welcome message from that guy, but it could have also just been all in his mind.
Okay, so just to run by it, your idea is that the captain of the Zelbinian recorded a welcome message for people like newly on board that was just activated, and that welcome message went, "Welcome, Rigel, to your doom," or whatever the fuck.
Did he specifically mention his name?
Hello, Rigel. I'm greatly disappointed in you. Welcome home.
It's kind of like the thing that, like, a sadistic commander of a prisoner ship would, like, record for people who are, like, now shuttled on board and, like, let them know that they are doomed. And
so into this. I'm so into this idea that, like, Jelena and her team walked on board and they were treated to, like, a bim, bim, bim. Welcome to the Zelbinian. Yes. Like, oh, yeah, thank you for the welcome.
Welcome to your doom. They seem to be that kind of asshole.
The job now is to get the defense screen back
up and running.
Up and running. And Crichton has said, I'm gonna help Jelena. And once they're alone and getting the work done, like, apparently he recognized it as a progressive power draw, and it makes sense to him.
There's a little bit of techno babble there, and they have a little connecting moment where you can see them, like, bonding over the repairs that need to be done.
Yeah, and this is getting closer.
This becomes very obvious. I mean, I even thought for a moment that Jelena and Aaron were, like, being a little bit flirtatious with each other at some point.
Oh yeah, there was a lot of sort of grunty, like, eye-frelling,
a little bit of sweaty eye-fucking going on there between those two.
Yeah. That was indeed really hot. I mean, she does show some vulnerability. Like, Jelena admits that she's not very confident in whether she can actually pull this off. And Crichton goes, like, well, why didn't you tell anyone?
I didn't want to be executed for failing to try.
Oh, that's, like, tells us a lot about the peacekeeper mentality.
Yeah. And Crichton puts his foot down, and he tells this young woman, hey, we're not like that. And he tells her,
we are not killers.
Well, Crichton, like, let's take a little look at what we've done in the past few episodes. Like,
we will kill them all.
No. Kill.
I'm gonna kill him.
Kill anyone?
I killed a fellow soldier.
I'll torture him, then I'll kill him.
I would still have preferred killing them on the spot.
They're not, okay, sure, they're not wanton killers, but they're not killers.
True. I mean, it's all pretty much been in self-defense.
Has it all been, actually, I'm thinking about it now. I'm thinking about, like, Thrown for a Loss, where even Bekesh, you know, the staplehead, goes like, oh, you didn't kill any of my men.
Yeah.
You didn't kill them.
Guess I'm not that kind of a guy.
Exactly.
They all killed anyone.
Well,
hey.
Nothing that jumps out at me, but...
Right? I mean,
Dave, there was a lot of shooting in that episode.
Which may be a little telling for us, that we can just tolerate the killing of an alien creature and not really...
Yeah.
Okay, so the episode that we had, IET, nobody really... They didn't really kill anyone. No. Well, he shoveled some people over the head, and they almost definitely had an aneurysm. Yeah.
Yes, but...
Definitely Crichton definitely killed some people with a shovel. That's his preferred... That's how he likes to kill. Exodus from Genesis.
No.
Well, he killed some bugs, but they're not people.
No.
Yeah, and they were okay. We had Thrown for a Loss. Then the next one was Back to the Future.
Also no killing. So it's like they've been
maybe
pretty,
they aren't killers.
They've been pretty good for that, yeah.
Well, let's hope that this trend continues for the rest of the series, and they're all wonderful pacifists.
And then, thank God, it's Friday again. Like, several people got hit over the head, but again, I don't think anybody was killed. I mean, Dargo's Keyblade must not be particularly effective.
God. I know that you're going to keep calling it that, and every time it's going to get me.
Meanwhile, on the Chiang ship, there's a change of command.
Now, the Sheyang, I thought it was so cool to see them again, because we'd seen them before.
They looked a bit like Celestians, but other than that, where did we see them before?
Okay, so they were very briefly in the background in, like, the first episode of the Commerce Planet.
When they're on the marketplace
thing. Yes, exactly.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And Zan's talking to one of those fish heads, and, like, Douglas Kemper or whoever it was went, oh, that one, polish that up, we're going to write an episode about those. They look so cool.
Yep.
Like, I thought they had such an interesting culture that was presented, because they had this... I mean, just an awful ship with lots of steam, just like the Zelbinian, frankly.
I mean, the Zelbinian, like, is probably there because it's been shot at and, like,
I mean, in terms of aesthetic, as a sort of production point of view. Even more,
because it's much more crowded. There's ducts and pipes and stuff running all over the place.
And they had the sort of, like, First World War leather, like, pilot's helmets.
Caps, yeah, although it's very hard to see where their helmets stop and their skin begins. And then we've got Hatch Guy. I've noticed...
Evron, yes.
I mean, you only ever see him sticking his head out of the hatch and, like, talking to people.
He's the ceiling cat of the Cheyenne. There's an interesting sort of power dynamic where the more experienced captain sort of advises caution, and he's, like, first in command, a younger sort of upstart who wants to prove himself.
Even you at your age have never claimed such a prize.
Actually sort of shovels him over the head and takes command.
Yes.
There's a fish fight!
Oh, God. I think this is when they start shooting at each other, isn't it?
Evron! Prepare to attack!
There's a scene where Crichton and Jelena are working on refixing the ship, and he's got this cute little, like, creme brulee torch which he's using to try to solder the cables back in place or anything.
Yeah, it's adorable.
And
he is the Brad to Jelena Jolie, which is...
Oh, yeah, is that what we're calling her? Okay.
Well, I mean, not if you're going to respond to it like that. Like, I thought,
okay.
No, that's fine. It's clearly, I'm sure I'm going to come up with something better than Jelena Jolie, which I think was probably the best that I had.
Jolene.
Do you notice how there was a lot of sci-fi music through this episode?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Well, okay. Like, I don't want to be mean about the makers of the music for the show, who generally do a really good job. But, like, there was a lot of these sort of tender moments or quiet moments where you got a lot of, like, synthesizing.
Okay.
Like, it was kind of
when they were eye-fucking each other and.
Speaking of eye-fucking, wow! I'm going to have to bleep out a lot this episode.
Oh.
She got some sparks in her eye and she backed against Crichton.
Oh yes.
And there was this really cute, sort of moment.
Yeah.
Where
Reminded me a little bit of that scene in The Empire Strikes Back where Leia and Han Solo get thrown into each other again, and he's like almost an exact mirror of that, actually.
You're right. Like, he's pressed up behind her while they're focusing on the repairs, and then,
suddenly she's in his arms. And
pressing against each other, and that's when she observes that, apparently human and Sabbatian males are not so different.
It seems human and Sabbatian men are much the same.
Yes.
So he's got a little science boner.
Yes, I think he has. Also, what I noticed, like Moya is a big ship, but compared to the Sabbatian, she's tiny.
Zelbinian.
Zelbinian.
Even the big ones go down.
She's minuscule in comparison. Yep. It's so huge. Yeah, like over a metre long at least. No wonder they're scared of these guys, and also no wonder that that Crichton is worried about ever encountering the winner of this fight again.
Oh yes, whoever it was that shot up the Zelbinian, I'll get it right this time now.
Very good. But the next person who's going to shoot up the Zelbinian is the Cheyenne, who, like, they've tried to open fire before, and then they were rebuffed when Zan very cleverly turned on the vid screen just as Dargo was letting loose his frustration.
Oh, yes.
I'll rip out your throat. I will shit down your neck. I will. And then he switched helpfully to Luxon.
I spit on your grave, you sons of cowards. I rip out your throat. I
Pilot. Transmit his image to the Cheyenne vessel.
But what would
the... Do it!
A Luxon? We're fighting a Luxon! Terminate plasma! Terminate plasma attack!
That must have been quite a tricky scene to film, actually. Just like for an actor Such to keep up that kind
job.
Of rant in a language, which, as we know, doesn't really exist. I mean,
right,
I don't think there's an actual made-up Luxon language, so they're just like, yeah, just wing it.
I wonder if he did it himself. I wonder if Anthony Simcoe sort of came up with the sounds
or
for it.
Or there's just like this huge off-scene teleprompter, which is like, like, just read this and just blabber and wave your tentacles around for a little bit.
I mean, it was proper intimidating, and the old captain was intimidated, but there has since been a fish fight, and the...
fish fight.
The younger upstart took over and is not so easily intimidated.
And he's been shooting Zilbinian and Moya, of course.
And
they just in time managed to raise the shield so that this fire weapon that they're firing at the ship is successfully deflected.
It was so cool. Like, it's this sort of electric red sheath that flies around the Zilbinian. I've never seen anything like it.
No.
It's so weird because, and yes, it's full of gaps because a proper defense shield is two systems overlapping so that there are no gaps. If you only run the one, then there are these mobile gaps.
Or you
gaps.
Can just like have a single one that doesn't have gaps, but you know, that would be even better.
Okay, so you're a defense screen specialist now, aren't you? You're a peacekeeper scientist.
That's how I would design
one. Okay, well tell me how you would design it, PK
without
Tech
gaps.
Boy.
Without gaps.
But that's like the front fell off.
Well, yes.
Right? The front shouldn't have fallen off. Yeah, well, the front clearly did. Well, maybe this is just how the science works out. Okay, so how many... Hey, are there precedents in Earth science? You know a lot about, like, space travel and stuff. Like, are there...
We don't have
engineering
force fields.
No, we don't have force fields.
Like, the
fields.
Best wheels... Like, the idea of a force field is that you, like, build some sort of electromagnetic reference wall.
Right.
And the easiest way to do that is to build a brick wall. It's like doing that with electricity and power, it doesn't work.
Yeah,
like nobody's ever been able to manage to do that. Anything
just
like
just actual walls generally do better.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, in general, like, are there systems that we know where you need two of them for it to work because one of them really kind of doesn't really do it very well?
Well, generally speaking, in firewalls, it is recommended to have two.
Right.
Specifically from different vendors, because then one of them can protect the other one against the backdoors that the vendor of the first one built in, or like if you know.
Oh well, couldn't they have been designed without backdoors?
Well,
they were designed
without backdoors. But you know, when these things get made in China, sometimes like you know the Chinese government gets them in, or a checkpoint is made by the Israeli. So the Mossad probably has a backdoor in that, and the Cisco firewalls are made in the U.S. So the CIA probably has a backdoor in that. So.
Hey, Kay, do you want to maybe start a different podcast about this? Because this
you
is...
asked.
I did. But it just sort of sounds like mistakes are made, and that's why you take two.
It wasn't built and it had gaps in it. It was designed to have gaps in it, which you wouldn't do with a force field.
Unless there were benefits to having gaps in
force
field,
like
not overloading
but
crushing the ship that it's in. Oh, maybe that's it. Maybe if you had a perfect defense screen,
that
it would eventually...
I'm sure we can make up some reason why it isn't meant to be like that.
Yes, we absolutely should.
But I don't think we should go and make up technobabble for the show. You know, it's like...
You are very right, because this is usually a very technobabble light show.
Yeah.
And I'm just coming at it with sort of Star Trek sensibilities. Thank you for yanking my leash.
So, on a little side note here, I noticed that, like, I'm not sure if this was accidental or not, but at one point during this encounter, Zahn refers to pilot as the pilot. So he uses the definite article.
Yeah.
Which I don't think they've done before. It's always been pilot rather than the pilot.
Now, I'd be content to like call that a little slip of the tongue early in the series. But when Zahn and Dargo were first under threat, like they were talking about abandoning Moya.
Yes.
And retreating to the Zilbinian, which could withstand like more fire, within sort of earshot of the clamshell, they were talking about Moya like a ship.
Yeah.
So maybe like Zahn was in that headspace and thinking about Pilot as the pilot, as just a staff member.
And then of course you'd have to convince Pilot to come with them as well, which I don't think he would. I mean, he's bonded to Moya, so
right.
But
like they get sort of called back from that because Pilot appears in his clamshell and he says,
"Dargo, Zahn, Moya and I are very afraid of fire."
Oh, yes.
And like, oh, I mean, when you hear that, you can't flee, can
no,
you?
No, like, there's like, he's like, he sounds very timid and like, yeah, a little afraid. Well, clearly afraid.
Yeah, which is what they're being threatened with. Like, yeah, there are these plasma projectile weapons, but Moya is... Like, she's a living being. She's an animal.
Yeah.
I don't know necessarily that that's the right word, but... And she's afraid of fire, and she doesn't want to be hurt.
No.
And yeah, okay, of course. So they sort of abandon the idea of abandoning Moya very quickly. But the Sheyang, whose attack has just been rebuffed by the a gappy defense screen that the Zilbinian has wrapped around itself and tiny, tiny Moya, they decide on a new strategy because the old captain, Turak... has reawoken and...
Apparently he was not dead, he was just like knocked unconscious, and he takes back control of his ship.
Answer to me, Lomas.
with such grace and menace at the same time. Like, he doesn't like immediately execute his subordinate.
Nope.
Like, okay, you committed mutiny.
To displace an overlord during battle and then fail.
And you failed? That's a problem.
Like, yes.
One of those would have been okay.
But not both, yes. Yeah. And he basically gives him a chance to redeem himself.
Yeah.
By leading the boarding party. And I thought that was such a cool shot when you've got these little...
Yes.
These revolver cartridges on the outside
yes,
of the ship.
And bullet pods that are being fired.
They're being rotated into the launcher and then fired off at Moya because the plan is to like fly through the gaps in the defense screen and board her.
The gaps are moving and you have to come in at speed, so yeah, it's a kamikaze run.
Perhaps one day they will sing songs of your early death.
Meanwhile, Creighton and Jelena are having a little moment.
Oh, they're having another little moment.
Yes, but this time they're kiss, K-I-S-S-I-N-G.
It was a real, like, jock and cheerleader moment.
Oh, it was so. It's just like, and they're leading to each other, and it's like, oh, yeah, will they, won't they, will they? Oh, am I going to kiss? Oh, yes, they're kissing. Oh. And of course, at this point, Aaron shows up.
Sorry for interrupting.
Grunty, sweaty, hairy Aaron shows up, and she's been carrying the heavy things back and forth. Like, she's moving the other half of the defense screen onto Moya. And so it's like, oh, no, this is fine. I'm not emotionally invested in this
Please
at all.
Please go on ahead.
Look, hey, what happened back there was...
None of my business.
She stalks off. Creighton runs after her while she's carrying this big crate over her head.
I'm sure you can see how heavy these things are. There's at least another 10 in there. Do not come down this corridor without one.
Walking
down the corridor.
She makes a real point of just carrying an extra muscular...
And each time he stops her, she puts it down, and then they have a short argument, and then she lifts it up again, and then 10 meters further down the corridor, she puts it down again, and they they continue their argument. And Aaron's clearly jealous. And like, she kind of confesses that, like, in the beginning, she kind of saw something in...
That he was interesting.
Creighton.
In the beginning, I found you interesting.
Me.
Yes, but only for a moment.
They did have some of that chemistry earlier on as well. So yeah, it seems that like just a little pair of PK tech girl eyes and like Creighton's,
and suddenly
like, all
his
over the
heart
place.
Is I mean, clearly he just wants more science somehow because that has been so well established. He's so clearly the scientist of the bunch. Obviously, he'd be attracted to. But I kind of like that they were honest with each other for a change. That hasn't happened for
and they're going to science the heck out of it.
I am a scientist.
You know, there is somebody else throughout all of this that we haven't really paid a lot of attention to, and that's Rigel is continuing with his quest of confrontation.
Yes,
he's continuing to have these flashbacks as he's going through the ship, like, and we see the torture that he suffered at the hands of Captain Durka,
which was just a little bit of getting punched around.
Yeah, while he was sitting inside like
a bird
BDSM cage.
Yes,
again in his underwear.
That's my underwear.
The same woolies that he's still wearing after 100 cycles.
Well, he is aquatic, so he probably
accidentally
rinsed it.
And Zahn actually has to like coax him out from under the console or somewhere wherever it is he's hiding.
Yeah,
and convince him to go back into the ship.
Hey, what did I tell you? Go and find a corpse.
Yeah,
find his corpse.
That, hey, any corpse will make you feel better.
Make peace with the corpse.
Just piss on the corpse, and you'll feel great.
Whereas,
I feel like we watched different episodes. Like,
I didn't see any corpse pissing, but, you know, spitting, yes, but...
A lot of spitting, and not just from Rigel.
Oh, yes, because our Sheyang alien has made its way on board the ship and is now brutalizing his way towards the others.
Not carrying a rifle, because he can...
Breathe fire. He's a f***ing dragon.
They spit fire? How come nobody tells me this stunt? How come nobody tells me they spit fire? Aaron!
Hey, Aaron, I love how his big point is like, why doesn't anybody tell us this shit?
Yes, I mean, part of it's probably like things are assumed for that he knows these things or something.
Yeah, we said Sheyang.
Yeah.
Come on.
Sheyang victim, burnt to death.
Everybody knows Sheyang breathed fire.
We knew they were like being burnt. And like, of course they did that like with their mouths, not with their guns. Like... the things you don't know when you're a stranger in a strange land.
Now, there's a bit of a chase through the ship. Apparently, like, Aaron is prevented from reaching the defense screen bay or whatever where John and Jelena are at work. Jelena is operating what looks to me, honestly, like a phone switchboard. She's
something like that. With the plugs and everything.
Lots of that. While John, his big job is to hold two polarized plates apart so that they don't touch each other.
Which seems like there must be better ways to do that than just, like, have the human hold them apart. Like, you know.
Yeah, a sheet of rubber.
Beat them down. Actually, I thought, and it's a shame that didn't come up, because at this point I thought that the Xiang was going to get, like, squashed between those two plates or something. They were going to use the attractive force of those plates to just, like, catch him. Which
that would have been clever.
Which didn't pan out, unfortunately, but this was one of those moments where you're sitting there like, I wonder if that's going to happen. And, well, in this case, it did not.
Like, as a scientist, he should probably know that when you've got two things that absolutely should not touch each other, what you've got to do is use some spacers and, like, a pencil and a screwdriver
and
to keep them apart.
And you make sure they can't touch.
I was making a kind of a poor taste demon core
joke. Oh, right. It was a screwdriver.
Screwdriver, but, and then the screwdriver rolled off, and it was a terrible nuclear accident.
Yes, and people died several days later in most horrible ways. Yeah, let's go with that. That's like that's definitely the kind of atmosphere that we want for our podcast.
I'm so sorry for leading us there. but it's kind of appropriate. I mean, they are under threat of death. So you've got Jelena in the switchboard. You've got John holding those panels up, keeping the demon core apart,
and a fire breathing lizard coming at them.
And what are they supposed to? Like, they can't do anything. So Crichton does the one thing which he can do is he yells a swear at him and calls him
a gas hole. Which is like,
and then Aaron to the rescue. Like, she rappels down with her big ass gun
just
that seems to grow every episode.
And she just, like, she Rambos him right out of there, and
one shot and poof.
Yeah, he goes up in a ball of flame, which I guess, like, if he was building up a good head of steam.
He was huffing and puffing.
And if you puncture his gas bladder or whatever it is that he has to do these things with, like, I mean, they're very combustible. I mean, like,
it's, they would have to be.
Kind of dangerous in a foxhole, you know?
He made it through, like, a steel door. He, like, while he was...
He was just burning it down.
You had sort of, like, the Jurassic part of a live... I almost said Velociraptor. Yes, Velociraptor moment there when he was on the other side of, like, the circular window. Did you hear what Aaron said, by the way, when she blew him up?
No.
Sorry about the mess.
It's like Han Solo and Guido. Yes, come on, that's great.
With this, the other Cheyenne, I guess, make a run for it. Cheyenne, whatever. Cheyenne.
Actually, no, they should be the Cayenne. Because of the fire. Because of the fireballs.
Oh, yeah. So
they're the Cayenne aliens. There you go.
They give up. The captain actually makes a bit of a compliment, I think.
You had nothing. But you used it well.
Yeah, because Dargo, like, continues the ruse. Oh, my soldiers will return soon.
My officers are drawing up plans to retaliate.
I doubt so.
You had nothing and you used it well.
Yes, that was the one.
Like, that's kind of cool. Like, and he tells his new second in command, sealing Xiang.
Yes.
Like, there's no shame in losing to a clever opponent, but Dargo.
Cardago, I make it a point to someday kill my clever opponents.
Which seems like a bit of a boast for such a cowardly species, which they... I mean, I guess they're not cowardly exactly, but, like, calculating is probably a better way to put it. Wouldn't think they'd be the kind to hold a grudge, but, you know...
The thing about Farscape that I appreciate so much that sets it apart from a lot of other science fiction... It's not sort of the D&D racial alignments. It's about people. Like, the Xiang may, or the Cayennes may have this reputation, but this is, what was his name? Turak, I think, was the main dude.
Yeah.
And, like, this is his personality.
True.
And he's not like any other Xiang, because, like, the rest of the Xiang, you saw that they were different as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, we don't have the planet of the uniform personality people.
Yes, and, exactly.
Yeah, we have different people with different strokes.
We have that with the peacekeepers as well. Like, we've seen Krace and we've seen Aaron, and now we've also seen Jelena.
I mean, at this point, I really got the feeling that there was more of a, not just a rank, but also a social class structure, which I guess makes a lot of sense in a militaristic society like
We got that before when. They were trying to operate like the piece of scanning tech that was like it was peacekeeper technology, and hands it to Aaron. Aaron goes, "No,
techs are using, not the infantry."
Oh yeah, so I remember that. Yeah. That's not me. Like,
they're an entirely different social stratum. And I mean, you could see from Jelena like how mousy and terrified she was. She's quite accustomed to being bullied like that.
Yeah, she was a little shorter than Aaron, but so I wonder if that's incidental or if that's like an actual thing. With
do you think that the Sebastians are sort of like a height based hierarchy?
Well, it could be that
the almighty tallest,
right? Or maybe you just pick the tall ones to be the warriors and the fighters. Which actually, for pilots, you want short people because you have like less problem with G forces,
right?
Also, it's like a thing that the Americans very deliberately did. For all the meetings with the North Koreans,
right?
They picked the largest, tallest Marines that they could find. So they just like all look, they're all like two heads taller
giant,
than all of the.
Super intimidating.
Yeah, exactly. Like these are super soldiers. And
way to go. I mean, it was that backfired for Napoleon. Napoleon surrounded him, like his Praetorian guards were big, huge bruisers.
Yeah.
And that's like one of the reasons why he wound up with a reputation for being a short dude.
Yeah.
Like, he was not short.
He was perfectly average for his time.
But he was only like 5'3" in French feet. French feet are longer.
Oh, okay.
Right. So, and the English then thought, 5'3", that's nothing.
So, after the fight has been won, the crew is now saying goodbye to Jelena, who I suppose they're leaving behind on
that
the ship.
That seems like the plan,
Because, I mean, I guess the other ship is coming back for her, because she was left there behind for a purpose.
Yeah.
And they go like, is she going to tell on us? And then Aaron goes like, no, she won't tell, because like...
Yes.
You've been in touch with us, and remember what happens to people who get corrupted.
Yeah. Irreversibly contaminated.
You know what happened to me. That could happen to you.
You can see her thinking about this and coming to the conclusion that, she probably should shut up about this whole affair.
Yeah,
and, like,
there's really nothing in it for her.
No, I mean, like, the worst case scenario is that the crazy commander is going to, like... I mean, what did she say? Like, the penalty for that is death or worse, exile?
Yes. Well, and Aaron sort of agrees. Like, she confides in her. You can barely imagine how bad it is to be exiled from everything you know and to be alone. Because this is something like earlier on when Jelena was trying to earn Aaron's trust, or at least like believe that she was capable of telling the truth. Like, she was talking about, okay, as an officer, I think that you, Aaron Sun, are a traitor and should be put to death, and you deserve the punishment.
But as a Sebastian, I believe you are deserving as I. To know the truth about a cultural treasure.
Which is what the Zelbinian is, which is like I was even surprised that Krayst would even come back for Jelena.
Yeah.
Because he's so hell bent. But even he, with his total maniacal focus on Crichton, is going to come back to find out what happened to the Zelbinian, a historical treasure.
Yeah, specifically because they left people on board to investigate something.
Do you think that he would care that much about
Because he wouldn't leave them, just leave them.
Yeah, fair point. He'd be more careful about his resources.
Yeah, it makes no sense to do that if you're not planning on coming back. So yeah, it's a little tearful moment, I guess, where Crichton and Jelena say goodbye to each other. And
it's like the end of summer camp. No, we'll stay in touch. We'll find out.
Which
we'll
is bullshit.
There's a,
what are you going to do? Write? Like, throw out mail in a bottle?
You don't know what planet you're going to be on. You've got no way to get in touch with each other.
They're literally running from the ship that she's supposed to be on. It's like, how on earth are they going to... Well, definitely not on Earth, but how are they ever going to meet up with each other?
And more kissing.
More kissing.
And it's very sad, and they say goodbye.
And then like
another melancholy ending to an episode.
Yeah,
of
I noticed that. That like they seem to end on a down note quite often.
Yeah, and you know, I don't mind it. I think that's a good tone for the show, because you've got the ups and the downs, and like the ups are very high and the downs are very low. And so at the end you're kind of glad you made it through.
A little bit of melancholy.
I mean, the highest was probably Rigel when he finally found the corpse that Zan found him to, told him to find.
And he gets to spit in the face of his old tormentor.
Spit again. The desiccated face with the... Do you notice how he had, like... It's like he was wearing a silver contact lens. Like, one of his pupils was metallic.
Oh, yes.
So cool.
And he apparently shot himself through the head. Because he's carrying this gun in his hand, and Rigel gets his moment of...
You died like a coward.
Yeah.
You killed yourself, Doka. You coward.
He gets his, moment of catharsis, of closure, maybe.
Yeah.
At least he outlived his tormentor.
Right. It's kind of a shame that nobody else gets to share this with him, because it's a huge thing. Like, He's been in prison for 130 cycles.
No,
he's been,
less than that. He was disposed 130 cycles ago, and the ship has already been lost for 100 cycles. So he's only been on that ship for a maximum of 30, because he got off the ship before.
Right,
he,
yeah, but there were other ships since then.
Oh, right, yeah,
right?
That's true.
It's been
a
continuous...
Oh, right, yeah, you're right, yeah, he has been...
That
like,
just happened to be the first one where he was tortured.
Right, yeah, you're right.
So,
this
is easy to overlook with Rigel, because he's such a dickhead, and he's so petty, but he's an incredibly traumatized person. Like, even Dargo, for whom the hurt is much more...
fresher?
Fresher.
Yeah.
Like, and it's also been 8 cycles, but he's only 30.
A very big difference. And Rigel is like, God knows how old, like hundreds probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he got some closure on a trauma that
he's been carrying with him for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, good on him.
Bit of an odd B plot to weave through the story. Where but just Rigel being off doing his own thing and never really interacting with any of the other. Well, Zahn a little bit here and there, but.
No, that's a good point. A lot of the times the B plots get at least like a pairing that is interesting to discover. But it was really Rigel on his own.
Yeah.
I thought it was kind of impressive that Rigel on his own kind of works, honestly.
It does, yeah. It made for an interesting bit of backstory. And I guess it also explains a little bit more about his character, where he's like, you know him as this disposed ruler.
Yeah.
And now you know that he's like...
that's going to be it. Yeah, definitely.
Now that you know that he's had his like, the time imprisonment has been a long time, and it's been pretty hard on him, and probably explains why he's a bit of a shithead, and like also probably why he's like focused on food. And
I don't know. I imagine he was a shithead before. I mean, he might be like 1900 years.
I mean, there was a reason that they kicked him off the throne. So like, popular rulers seldom get disposed.
Okay, that's the last time, and maybe one more time in the next episode. But good gravy. Crichton and Jelena have promised to be pen pals after having been, I guess, penis pals.
Are we getting that? No, I mean, I won't ask. I said I wouldn't ask you questions about things that happen in the future.
Very good.
I won't ask any questions about things that happen in the future, because we'll see them happen or not.
Yes,
so I'm not going to ask whether or not
she
comes back in the plot or not.
And we end with Crichton and Aaron. They've had a moment where they were really honest with each other. And this time, like, she rebuffs him because she doesn't think that he can understand what she's going through.
No.
Like, confronted with this cultural treasure and being separated from her people. And then he tells her what he thinks about when he thinks about going back to Earth and, like, walking past his dad's car in his best friend's house.
Yeah, which seems like a bit of a weird thing.
And then he thinks, but what if I come back and they're all dead?
Oh, yeah, I noticed that. That was a bit weird. I thought that was a very strange comment. It's like, does he, like, think that he's, like, not traveled in space but in time or something? Like, that he's a little bit of a Buck Rogers himself? That he's, like, been,
coming
like...
coming back to Buck Rogers.
I know.
Yeah,
I mean,
no,
like...
you're right. In the 24th and a half century.
Why does he think that they might all be dead? I mean...
I think that's an interesting observation. I think a lot of this episode is about trauma.
Yeah.
The Zelbinian having been destroyed, the flagship of the peacekeepers, Aaron being confronted with her isolation, Rigel with his torment, Dargo with his helplessness.
Yeah.
That helplessness is something that Crichton must feel all the time. Like, he has no way of knowing.
And he has no control over coming back. Or
so his imagination could just go anywhere. He can think, it can be anything. They could all be dead. And he can just, like, sit there and his brain running through this cycle of worry with nothing to do against it. And
I stand corrected,
says Aaron, because apparently he does understand what is happening for her as well.
I mean, she knows they're alive, but, like, they might as well be dead because she's been exiled.
Yeah, and her unit's been demoted. Like, whoa.
Yeah.
Oh,
harsh.
Powerful, powerful stuff. Like, I know we started this this podcast with the idea we'll have some fun with zany aliens.
Yeah.
And then the show hits you with this.
Yeah. Right in the feels.
Right. Right in the feels. So how did it feel for you? Like, I mean, this is a lot, like, heavier as an episode than we've seen before. Like,
there's a few heavy bits in there, but most of it is just like dealing with the situation at hand. So, I mean, there's like they insert these little the KN alien. I mean, it's like they are spicy, so it makes sense. These elements are nicely woven into the story.
Right?
I think that's very well done. They're not like they flow from the events. Very naturally.
Yeah, yeah. There's a, like, it's an allegory for itself.
Yes.
in terms of the action and the experience that they've, like, I looked it up who the writer of this show was, and it was someone called Nan Hagen, and this is the only episode she's done. I'm like, wow,
okay,
yeah. you nailed it. Now
apparently had something going for her. Yeah,
like, I don't even know how the writing works, whether they had a writer's room.
Uh-huh.
Like Star Trek often had, where they'd occasionally like buy a script from someone else. But like, what would it be like writing for Farscape?
Especially the first season, nobody,
exactly.
Nobody, yeah, write something about aliens on a ship. Like, here's your premise, and go.
This script would have to be written before like a single scene had been filmed.
Yeah, I have no idea how that went. Like, did they have like the full script for the entire season? Like, I would think they had. Like, the
I will do some investigating. Let me see if I can find out more about this. Maybe get in touch with some of the writers. I've seen that some of them are on Twitter. Who knows? Maybe we'll get lucky. Cool.
Yeah, love to hear about that. Like, if there's not really a pilot episode either, is there? Was it like immediately pulled
there
out for an
episode about pilot? No.
Down cocky.
yes. I pulled us back up out of the melancholy and into the silliness. No, I think the opening episode was called The Premiere, or Through the Eye of the Needle, depending on where you...
But it's not actually... There was not an actual pilot episode, which was then pitched to the network, which then decided to pick it up, and then they made the first season.
No, they went straight there.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say.
I think they could do that because, like, it was a co-production to begin with. Like, a lot of the financing came probably from the Jim Henson Company itself.
I mean, you did mention that they wanted to showcase their ability.
Right,
so they probably went like, okay, we'll do this on the cheap, and...
I mean, they sure didn't.
Oh, well, no, I mean, like,
in the end,
as in cheap for the producers, and like give them a discount, or we'll do this for minimum pay, and then put much more effort into it than they were supposed to. But God damn, it looks good.
All right. So before we close, I want to continue like at the segment that we kind of invented last week. What gave you the willies, and what gave you a Woody?
She gives me a Woody.
She gives you the willies.
Oh, dear.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
So we can take it kind of broad. Like, Woody, whatever you thought was good, Willy. I mean, what do you think?
Can we have a segment called Willy or Woody?
Okay, well, that gets my Woody for this episode. Very, very good.
Okay, so I think Willy would definitely be for Rigel when he had his confrontation moment with his old tormentor.
Yes.
Yeah, getting those flashbacks into the torture
when
that
he
had.
When he was in his BDSM birdcage.
Yes.
And it has just occurred to me that we should say it differently, like, that gave you the willies, because otherwise it sounds like your Willy goes to Rigel,
that would be
and that's
Woody.
Probably...
Yeah. Ooh, no.
No, so that definitely gave me the willies as well.
Yes. So what's the Woody moment?
Oh, like seeing the Zelbinian that, like, in the planetary rings,
just opening
in the
shot,
eye
much.
Of Rigel, that gave me such a science fiction Woody. It was so cool.
It was a great way to start the episode.
There's been so many of these like fantastic images in these early episodes that honestly have stuck with me for the 20 years since the show, like a Moya landing on the bog planet.
Oh yes,
and and like a twilight. I'd never seen that in science fiction.
And all the shots with the monarch and all those things like swarming around Moya.
Yes, exactly. It's so gorgeous. The special effects house at the time, Garner MacLennan, I think they mostly did.
It holds up. It's 20 years down, and you would not be able to tell that.
And that's the story so far, Scape.
We'll see you next week with episode number 108, That Old Black Magic, in which on a commerce planet, Crichton finds himself lured into an alternate reality controlled by Maldis, being who feeds of negative energy.
Oh, yes.
He is pitted against Krace in a fight to the death, leaving Zahn to tap into her old darkness to try and help him.
Oh, wow. I remembered some of that. I remember the Maldis, but I forgot that Krace was there. I'm super excited. If you're just as excited, you can find us on SoFarscape on Twitter at Facebook. Wow. One day. You can find us at SoFarscape on Twitter and Facebook and on SoFarscape.com. I'm Kaki.
I'm Kay.
SoFarscape, so good.